Okay, Rachel, I'll turn the recorder on. It is Wednesday, May 19th, approximately 2.05 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Eastern Daylight Time. This is the interview of Rachel Dollar of Smith Dollar Law Firm. This is George Wall from the SCIC, and Jeff Smith, also from the SCIC. Rachel, before we get started, we do it with most of our interviewees. Can you give me a brief professional background, starting with college?
Okay. So, college, I went to Santa Rosa Junior College, and then I finished my degree at Newport University in Newport Beach, California. I obtained my JD from Newport University. I went to work for a law firm, Smith Miller, that I was working at before I was in law school. I did construction and real estate litigation. The law firm then merged into another law firm by the name of Lanahan and Riley, where I continued to do construction and real estate litigation. I was sworn in 1998, and in about 2000, 2001, at Lanahan and Riley, a partner joined the firm who had a mortgage fraud practice, and they needed somebody to work in that practice. They selected me to do so. I became the associate under another woman who was to run the practice. She got ill and left, and I ended up taking over the practice that I managed until mid-2004 when I left and began a partnership with one of my associates from Lanahan & Riley. That partnership terminated relatively quickly, and then I opened this law firm that I'm at now, currently as the Dollar Law Firm. We changed the name to Smith Dollar in about 2006. I went back to Lanahan & Riley for a short period of time between 2006 and 2007, and then came back to Smith Dollar at that time. Since about 2000, I have practiced almost solely in the area of mortgage fraud and mortgage banking litigation. And I've represented lenders and secondary market investors in all types of mortgage fraud-related litigation, from mortgage insurance rescission litigation, lender liability defense litigation, RICO actions against fraudsters, other types of, you know, breach of contract cases against title insurance companies, borrowers, mortgage brokers, appraisers, various different participants within the mortgage transaction. I began a blog in 2004, Mortgage Fraud Blog, where we report on the various different indictments, convictions, sentencings that occur in mortgage fraud across the United States. I speak regularly on the topic. I have trained FBI mortgage fraud task forces. I have spoken for the regulatory community, for the Office of Thrift Supervision, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. I have, you know, spoken to various different industry groups, from real estate appraisers, mortgage bankers, mortgage brokers, escrow agents. I wrote a book in 2008 entitled Protect Yourself from Real Estate and Mortgage Fraud, which was published by Kaplan. Basically, I've been involved in the mortgage fraud, the legal side of mortgage fraud, for several years. I'm also a certified mortgage banker by the Mortgage Bankers Association, and I am a licensed California real estate and mortgage broker. Most, I think, of it.
Great. Thanks. Yeah, wonderful background.
Rachel, obviously I know you've talked to Tom Borders and Brad Bondi, so you know a little bit about what the FCIC is and what we're doing here. You know, what I'm looking at is what's mentioned in the Fraud Enforcement Recovery Act is the role of fraud and abuse as it relates to the mortgage market. That being said, as briefly as you can, what role did fraud play in the financial crisis, specifically mortgage fraud and bringing down the housing market?
Mortgage fraud defined as defined by the FBI, correct?
Yes, you know, the material misrepresentation to the lender.
It's my opinion that mortgage fraud was instrumental in the downfall of the housing market. the FBI tracks really or characterizes fraud in two ways, fraud for profit and fraud for housing. I think the FBI mostly focuses on fraud for profit. They say that their statistics actually 80% of the fraud that is reported to them is fraud for profit and only 20% is fraud for housing. I would estimate that those numbers in the real market are probably flipped and that probably 80% of the fraud that occurs is fraud for property and only 20% is fraud for fraud for profit. And fraud for housing is what really contributed to the economic downfall of the housing market.
As a follow-up to that, what is the basis of your opinion that it was the fraud for housing that was the major contributor?
The products that were available allowed borrowers, oftentimes in conjunction with other industry participants, to falsify their capacity to pay and to make significant misrepresentations, particularly within the stated income loan products. And in doing so, borrowers ended up being able to purchase homes that they couldn't afford, and it allowed the bubble to continue to grow. And at any time when you have a real estate market and you have a real estate bubble, there's a certain time when someone walks into a house and they say, I can't afford it. And it's like that with any economic market. You have supply and you have demand and you have an affordability level. And the stated income loan products coupled with interest only and option arm loans allowed borrowers to continue to obtain loans long beyond the time when affordability would have become a factor. So they really created an indicia of affordability that wasn't actual. And the fraud for property contributed to that because borrowers who got into these loans had to continue to refinance into lower interest rate loans or products that had teaser rates in order to be able to afford the payments that they had signed up for and the houses they'd signed up for. And in order to do that, they had to continue to demonstrate an ability to pay. And the only way for them to do that was to lie about their ability to pay. In the work that we're doing right now, and it's not just ability to pay, it's also other elements of their financial capacity. So in work that we're doing right now, we are sending out their re-verifications of deposits. So in a mortgage loan, a borrower often has to demonstrate reserves, and so they'll have to demonstrate that they have a certain amount of money in the bank. And to do that, they'll often either provide bank statements to the lender to support that, or they will provide a verification of deposit. So the broker or the lender sends out a verification to the financial institution that holds the account to verify how much that borrower has on deposit. And we're going back at this point in time and re-verifying those with financial institutions, both bank statements and verifications of deposits, and we are getting a 75 to 80% false return rate. So 75 to 80% of those verifications of deposit were falsified.
That's a shocking number.
Mm-hmm. And now, Rachel, when you say we, do you mean the bank, the mortgage industry as a whole?
No, my law firm.
Your law firm. So let me make sure I got that stat right. 75 to 80% of the verifications of deposit that you were that were submitted to your firm or your firm looked at were false?
That we're looking at. We're looking at one particular portfolio right now that it's not adversely selected, so these loans have not already been reviewed for fraud.
Okay.
They're just loans with losses.
Okay.
And in 75 to 80% of those loans, the deposits are falsified. Various different ways. Sometimes the borrower doesn't actually have the account. We'll have ones where the account had $12,000 in it and the verification of deposit is $312,000. We wrote a three in front of it. We'll have others where they were signed by an employee of the bank who didn't have authority to sign it and the numbers are wrong. You know, various different issues with them.
Now, when you're seeing ones where the bank employee has altered it, Are you counting that as, you know, the insider fraud or fraud for profit?
No.
Okay.
It's fraud. The difference between fraud for profit and fraud for housing is generally intent to repay. So in a fraud for property situation, a borrower intends to make the payments. They intend to either live in the property or use it for investment purposes, and there's an actual intent to own the property. In a fraud for profit scenario, the entire transaction is a for-profit transaction, and the intent is not to pay the mortgage. It's either to flip the property or default on the loan.
Okay.
Bank employees or loan officers would often falsify documents to help a borrower qualify for a loan, a borrower that actually intended to make the payments and because of whatever, you know, economic circumstances is now unable to, but the initial intent was to make the payments. So I don't think that it was a for-profit motivation in the bank employee or the loan officer, except to the extent that they received a commission for closing the sale.
Okay. What was the time period that was subject to review?
These were loans originated between 2006 and 2008.
Was there any particular reason why you selected that time frame as opposed to maybe a wider time frame that maybe started sooner, such as 2004?
As a law firm, I am directed by clients, and a lot of the work that we do focuses on civil recovery. And so with statute of limitations issues and various different other concerns, that was the time period that was selected.
That makes perfect
really
sense.
Focuses on civil recovery.
Okay.
And I will not, if requested or subpoenaed, be able to give additional information on that. It's attorney-client.
That's fine.
And, you know, I can discuss it very broadly, kind of what our findings are as a law firm, but nothing further than that.
That's fine. Could anything have been done to prevent this collapse from happening? And if so, what specifically?
Well, there's a lot of things I expect that could have been done. It's, you know, always Monday morning quarterbacking.
Right.
The product, I've really decided that if I ever see negative amortizing mortgage products come back into vogue, that I know that it's a bubble and it's time to get out.
Right.
And the fact that negatively amortizing mortgage products became the main product out there in a number of states should have been a huge red flag. It's an absolute indicia of unaffordability in a bubble. More controls around eligibility for products and what classes of borrowers should be eligible. There is a definite need for various different types of loan products because you have a lot of different types of borrowers. You have borrowers who have very different financial needs and abilities to react financially within a certain type of payment setup. But allowing products that are made for a certain borrower to become mainstream without any controls around them, I think contributed a lot. You know, stated income products can be very important to a self-employed borrower who doesn't have the length of self-employment to be able to, you know, establish a 2-year employment history
right.
with earnings. But when you take that into a W-2 borrower,
mm-hmm.
There's not the same reasoning to offer those products in that circumstance. Same way with negative amortizing products. I mean, when you're looking at someone who's a commission-based employee who receives large commissions at certain points in time in the year, and other than that basically lives on, you know, a draw against commission, or a negative amortizing product makes sense because at times they can make more than the minimum payment, and at other times they can make it up with large payments towards principal.
Now, can you define for us just what a negative, just for posterity purposes, what a negative amortizing product would be?
Negative amortizing is the pick-a-pay or option ARM product, where a borrower is given an option to make a payment that does not constitute the entire principal and interest, or even the entire interest that is accrued on the loan during that payment period.
Okay.
And that results in the interest that was not paid in that payment period being applied to the principal of the loan. You end up with a principal balance that increases.
Well, that kind of brings us to our next question. You mentioned loan products as being kind of one of the main causes. In speaking with some of the people here, I have a little bit more history in the market than I do, and I've read it other places too, that you know the no-doc loans, the option arms, they had some problems with those in the late 80s and early 90s, kind of around the S&L crisis, and they didn't work then. Why all of a sudden did they make a big comeback and people think that they would all of a sudden work, you know, the second time around?
It was the need to extend affordability in order to keep the market going. And in the eyes of the lenders, I think it became a real competitive issue. Even lenders that didn't want to offer the product and didn't believe that they were financially viable were really forced to on a competitive basis because other lenders offered them. And if they didn't offer the products that were available and were being offered by others, they would lose market share.
Now, is that because, you know, originations were shrinking?
No, not necessarily. It was very competitive. There was a lot of money being made in the mortgage market and in refinances and in purchases, and everybody wanted to get into the market because prices were going up. And because prices were going up, homes became very unaffordable to people. And the only way for them to continue to be affordable was to either go into something like a stated income loan product where the actual income wasn't put there, or a no-doc loan product where they didn't disclose income at all, and to be able to make less than the fully amortized payment, or to, you know, get a 1% interest rate for a short period of time and then have a low or a negatively amortizing payment.
Do you think that's because of the housing goals that have been set forth by the various political administrations?
I think that government housing pressure had something to do with it, but really in the end it was profit, and it was competition. It's very hard not to offer, to be competitive in the mortgage market and not offer the products that everybody else is offering.
Now, did those type of products start with, you know, did they start with traditional lenders, or was it people who were new to the market and maybe didn't necessarily have that historical viewpoint that someone who had been in the market for a long time would have had?
The products were available. They were always available through certain lenders.
Okay.
But I think that those lenders were more responsible about how they determined which borrowers to open the products to.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, if you look at, you know, World Savings. World Savings offered an option arm negative amortizing product for 20-some-odd years. And they were very successful, and they had very high collection rates. But they were very specific about their underwriting, and they worked with their borrowers in the servicing side of it. And once different management came in and that was kind of opened up and they stopped scrutinizing the borrowers as much, and it just became a product rather than something that was specially tailored for the borrower, and it became a mainstream product, is really when the problem started. I mean, the same thing with stated income loans. You know, Greenpoint offered them and offered low doc and no doc and stated income loans, but they were very specific about who they would give them to. You know, that was a product that was for self-employed borrowers.
So do you think if...
But once other lenders came in and started offering them and didn't put those parameters around them, it became a competitive issue.
Was that... Now, do you think the fraud proliferated because... Or, excuse me, proliferated because of lax underwriting? In order to stay competitive?
Not so much. I don't know that it was necessarily the lack of underwriting. I see underwriting differently than some people do. And underwriting on a residential side for a long time really hasn't been, you know, what we consider to be underwriting, like on a commercial side or in an insurance context where you're really managing risk.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the volume of residential, underwriting really is determining whether what's in front of the underwriter meets the parameters of the loan product. And that's a volume-based reality.
Because
mm-hmm. they're smaller loans, they're smaller products. They don't have the degree of scrutiny that you have when you're making a $10 or $20 million loan. Not that some residential loans weren't, but for the most part, you know, there are smaller loans.
Well,
and I don't know that the industry reacted as quickly as they should have when the reality became that loans, residential loans, were much larger.
Now, do you think because...
Small commercial loans actually went in the other direction, because underwriting on small commercial loans actually began to approximate that of residential underwriting rather than, you know, the large residential loans going the other direction.
Now, you mentioned that, you know, basically the goal is profit, and in order to stay competitive and to raise, you know, these are the products they had to offer. So, I mean, do you think the main culprits were the lenders just trying to stay profitable and competitive, or was it the trade industries who didn't want, you know, who wanted to see the members of their unions or their associations continue to be profitable?
For fraud, I really think that the biggest culprit is a lack of training and mistraining in the rank and file mortgage professional. If you saw how people in the industry learn how to do loans, you would see that fraud is taught. For instance, say that a loan officer goes into a brand new loan officer, and he goes in and he's taught by a senior loan officer who's going to teach him how to do a loan.
Mm-hmm.
And he sits there and it's like, okay, well, here's the borrower's W-2 income, and they don't make enough money. This is the house they want to buy. They don't make enough money. So here's a different loan product they can qualify. This is a stated income loan. And so this is how you do it. And you're just taught that. They're taught to move them into that, and that it's not important.
Along those lines, do you believe that a future set of guidelines and licensing procedures and maybe certifications and training would help to eliminate the occurrences of fraud in the future?
I think that increased training around fraud and around best practices in the very early stages of career development would help immeasurably. I teach across the country on fraud, and most people that I talk to who are escrow agents, appraisers, real estate agents, mortgage brokers, they don't recognize that what they're doing is fraudulent. No one has ever told them. And they really don't get it, because this is how they've been taught to originate loans since the beginning of time. And they are commission-based employees, They're trying to help people get into houses, and they're taught that this is how you do it. This is how you close a sale. And they just do not recognize the fraudulent nature of what they're doing for the most part.
Right. I mean,
or their consciences have been so dulled by years of you know, closing transactions in that way that they just don't even recognize it.
Right. I mean, in the securities industry, for instance, as an example, broker-dealers are required to go through a licensure process, a training process, and they're subject to a very strict set of ethical guidelines in most cases, a lot of times best practices internally within their organizations. And at the end of the day, if they break the rules, they can lose their licenses. There can be even more punitive types of measures. Their firms can lose, you know, their registration, etc. So I guess my question would be, is there a good cause looking backwards for a similar sort of regulatory regime, training, certification process, but for the mortgage industry, as opposed to just training on the issue of fraud?
I believe that a similar regulatory scheme would be helpful. The securities industry, at least to me, and I'm not in the enforcement side of it as much, but it just seems a lot cleaner. And I see people being disciplined. I see bad actors in the securities industry, but I also see action against them.
Right.
But some of the standards in the securities industry really just can't be applied the same way, and it may be some of those standards that make it more of more kind of amendable to that. They have the suitability standards in the securities industry, and so there's really a way to look at the broker dealer's conduct and determine it against kind of more an objective standard, whereas in the mortgage industry, people take money out of their houses for a lot of reasons. And there's really no way to implement kind of a suitability standard. So what kind of objective criteria are you going to have to, you know, gauge their conduct in, you know, that type of a situation?
Yeah, it's a fair question, and I think the comparability is difficult in many ways. However, I think the system of enforcement and having a body of rules, and also having an enforcement type of agency either at the state and or federal level could potentially be helpful.
You're talking about a large group of people to regulate, though. It's not just, you know, loan officers. You're talking, you have to look at escrow. Mm-hmm. You have to look at appraisal. And there are agencies and regulation and ethical standards and real estate agents. I mean, and there is regulation around all of that, but some of it is because it's state regulation.
As opposed to federal?
And so it's patchwork, and the state agencies don't have the funds to really, you know, discipline and engage in enforcement activity.
Well, Rachel,
I think that federal regulation would probably be helpful.
That's actually kind of a good segue to kind of the next topic. I don't know, you're probably aware of this. 2003 and 2000, and again in 2009, FinCEN had an advanced notice of proposed rulemaking. One was in June of 2003, and I think the other was in May of 2009, that would have subjected those not previously subject to money laundering rules to filing SARs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people like brokers, realtors, settlement attorneys, and so forth. Do you think if these had been in place early on, I realize it's Monday morning quarterbacking, but do you think if those people had been subject to anti-money laundering rules and subject to filing SARs, that would have helped curb the fraud? Or it, at a minimum, to kind of give a good gauge to how much fraud was actually going on?
Yeah, and I think that it would have increased the awareness of those parties. You know, when they passed the Georgia Real Estate Prevention, the Mortgage Fraud Act in Georgia, I'm just not going to remember the name of it. I'm going to say Georgia Real Estate Fraud Prevention Awareness Coalition, and that's not it. But the Mortgage Fraud Act in Georgia, when they passed that, they all of a sudden started getting a lot of calls from settlement agents and attorneys who were turning people in who were coming to close real estate transactions. So those people didn't really have an avenue for reporting before, and maybe didn't have real clear parameters around what was illegal and what the result would be if they engaged in that activity. And once that came out, and they kind of had real good parameters, and they got this flood of calls from them. So I think that imposing SAR reporting requirements would definitely increase the awareness.
Mm-hmm.
It would give us a better ability to track the actual extent of the problem as well. But that's, you know, I mean, proper property you're never really going to be able to track accurately, because it's just not discovered for the most part.
Well, and that's kind of another issue, is that most of the stuff that I've seen has said that, you know, mortgage fraud was underreported, either to, do you think that it was underreported because of just not having a mechanism to report it, or do you think it wasn't reported because of, at least in the early days, you know, the rising home prices? So, you know, if a home forecloses, if it's a property fraud and the home forecloses and the bank makes, you know, say $100,000 in the foreclosure, I mean, do you think that was part of it?
You're going to see a difference. I think you're going to see the difference there more in the prosecution rates, more so than the SAR reporting, because SAR reporting generally happens at the discovery of fraudulent information or suspicious activity, not when a loss is realized.
Okay.
In fact, if you look at the FBI released a chart back in 07 or 08 where they showed that only 7% of the suspicious activity reports that are filed
actually
contain any loss figures at all. Yeah. But I think that you would have had more activity that was reported, definitely, because you would be seeing it at different places in the chain where it was discovered. You'd also have the ability to, you know, fine institutions or companies for not reporting such activity.
Well, I mean, do you think the rising
would be nice?
The rising half, you know, if a bank does make a profit on a foreclosure, I mean, do you think that that helped mask the fraud a little bit?
Not really the fraud. I think it helped mask. I mean, it affected the losses that were coming out of it on in institutions that didn't have to report.
Mm-hmm.
It probably masked a lot of it. But in reporting institutions, they're not reporting when they suffer a loss, necessarily. I think that maybe they didn't discover as much because of the rising housing market. If you look at how lenders find fraud, they either are going to find it because of random audits, which they're required to do, or they're going to find it because generally they have large defaults and losses in a certain area, and so they start looking at that area and they decide, you know, it's a broker or someone else who is a common party among these loans, and they drill down, and that's how they discover a lot of fraud. So if you don't have wide-scale defaults in a certain area with commonality of parties, or you don't have losses, they're less likely to actually ever trip across the loans.
Okay. In 2004, in October 2004, Chris Swecker gives his testimony before Congress.
I know, prescient, wasn't it?
Yes. You know, about, you know, the epidemic that's coming, and, you know, the sky is falling. In November of 04, roughly November of 04, housing price or housing home ownership peaks.
Uh-huh.
But yet, mortgage fraud continued to go up both after housing peaked and Swecker's, you know, kind of warning about mortgage fraud. Do you think that, you know, his warning wasn't taken seriously? And why did the fraud continue to go up?
Part of it is because Countrywide became a bank and became subject to SAR reporting requirements. And that really I mean, if you look at the bump in 2004, that's Countrywide. And then they continued to report after that. And they were the largest originator in the U.S., and they weren't subject to SAR reporting requirements before that. Did his warning go unheeded? Absolutely. I mean, we saw increases in the FBI's attention towards mortgage fraud. We saw increased prosecutions. But on the streets, you know, you had a rising housing market, you had unaffordability, you had every single person who wanted to own a home, you had people believing that if they didn't get into the market now, they would never be able to get in the market. You had people going into places like Arizona and Nevada and speculating on homes because people were making so much money buying and flipping, the same way in Florida. And it was just a perfect storm. And so, while Chris Tucker's testimony may have been heard, you know, in the halls of the Capitol, on the street, it was never heard. It was never broadcast.
Do you think that, especially with regard to the rise in SARs that continued after that, do you think that was because of a rise of actually increasing fraud, or just more of a realization of fraud that was occurring that wasn't being reported?
I think that there was an increase in fraud between 2004 and 2007. Actual fraud. I don't know that the SAR, that I would correlate that to an increase in SAR reporting, but I do believe that in actual fraud, that it increased exponentially between 2004 and 2007.
I know you've sort of already hit on this previously, but I guess in a very short summary, why do you think that it dramatically increased during that period of time? I know you mentioned because of, you know, the money to be made in the industry and the increased competitiveness and also the increased commoditization of the products, but are there any other reasons that you would specifically identify?
Because of unaffordability. Unaffordability is what drove fraud. People had to lie to get the loans that they wanted and to buy the houses that they wanted. And whether they lied on their own, which doesn't happen very often, or they lied with the help of some industry professional.
As well.
And, you know, appraisals the same way. In order to refinance houses, appraisers were appraising based on what the refinance amount was, and value became completely disconnected from the appraisal process. So a million different pieces, but really what drove it was unaffordability.
Rachel, why the focus on the fraud for profit? If, you know, I know the Bureau says that 80% of their cases were the so-called fraud for profit, but FinCEN, in the scrubbing of their SARs from, I think, 1996 to 2006, said that, you know, two-thirds of the SARs that they found were borrower fraud.
I haven't seen that statistic. That must have been in the new one that I haven't read yet.
It's in the I can forward it to you. I have the reports of actually the testimony of the FinCEN director in 2009.
Fraud for profit is a catastrophic loss situation for a lending institution. So much as you have, you know, the Twin Towers were catastrophic for the insurance industry. They're a catastrophic loss. And mortgage fraud for profit is the same way in a lending institution. You have $100 million or $200 million concentrated loss in a very short period of time over a very small number of loans. Fraud for profit was more insidious. I mean, fraud for property was more insidious. And while there was more of it out there, because borrowers were paying their loans and were refinancing and the housing market was going up, fraud for property was not seen as a threat.
Even though that was the bulk of the fraud?
Yes. It was really not seen as a threat. In fact, I have heard people say that on a statistical basis, at least historically, this is, you know, post-2007, A borrower that lies to get into a loan is more likely to make their payment than one that qualifies.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think the borrower fraud or just wasn't, it wasn't eye-catching enough for U.S. Attorney's offices or DOJ or whoever?
Lenders weren't suffering losses on borrower fraud for the most part. And you have to, you have investigatory thresholds.
Right. Fully aware of those.
And those cases did not meet the thresholds. Also, a number of U.S. attorneys have looked at borrowers as victims. And I've actually had U.S. attorneys tell me that if they need a victim sitting at the table with them when they prosecute a case, and a lender is not a sympathetic victim, a borrower is. Which is another reason why I've had them, you know, state to me that they won't prosecute straw borrowers. Because they need a victim.
Do you think that high dollar thresholds were established for fraud as a way to kind of curb prosecution of those types of cases?
No, I think it's a prosecutorial reality. Just the sheer number of these cases and the difficult cases to investigate and prosecute. They're hugely document intensive.
Right.
And you have to pick and choose what you can do. And it's a nonviolent crime.
Right, exactly.
So where do you put your money? I definitely understand why there's a focus on, you know, violent crime, and you know, there's a murder happening in my neighborhood or someone stealing $20, I would rather the authorities dealt with the murderer.
Right.
But you know, white collar crime definitely gets overlooked, and in this particular circumstance, unfortunately, it caused a ripple effect that damaged our entire economy.
Do you think U.S. Attorney's offices realize that now? Do you think that's going to change after the collapse of the economy? You know, the housing bubble collapses and then the economy collapses in 2008. Do you think that's going to change, or do you think it's going to remain the same?
I don't know. I think some U.S. attorneys don't understand mortgage fraud and don't understand how to adequately prosecute it. I think training on that issue would be helpful as well. But investigators as well. Now, I talk to FBI agents and U.S. attorneys across the country
mm-hmm.
you know, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I do a lot of education around that. And I do run into circumstances a lot of times where it's just not understood.
Do you think that's part of the reason?
Whether it's the role of the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice in the appraiser's obligations and what the appraiser actually knows versus what they do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a huge issue when you look at fraud. Is USPAP, you know, a standard for fraud? No. But you can springboard from it in an analysis of what the appraiser should have done and what the appraiser knew versus what the appraiser actually did. And you can make your case off of it. But if you don't understand how USPAP fits in with the appraiser's obligations, then you can't make that argument. So, you know, I hear this a lot from law enforcement that, for instance, the appraiser didn't take money other than his regular fee, therefore he's not a participant.
Even though he might have inflated the value?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Wait.
I've actually seen it in indictments where they refer to the appraiser as a de minimis contributor to the fraud.
Do you think the lack of training and understanding kind of contributed to the lack of prosecution?
Yes.
Or at least early on?
Yeah. And I mean, there's several U.S. attorneys in the country who are very aggressive about mortgage fraud and bring prosecutions and understand mortgage fraud better than I do. But that's not a standard across the United States.
It kind of
you know, and there's some states where there isn't a lot of it being reported, so you know, it's less of a focus.
Mm-hmm. Kind of one more question on the, I guess we'll call it primary borrower fraud. Do you think that, especially with companies like New Century, do you think the front-end loaded business model, you know, the sales-generated business model, contributed to not reporting or not realizing fraud?
I think it created a lot of pressure within the organization.
Do you think
anytime that you have commission-based employees, you're going to end up with that push and pull. But did it create an environment on the back end not reporting it? You know, no. I mean, they have fraud departments, and those folks are definitely focused on fraudulent transactions and identifying them and reporting them. So it's done kind of in a different channel. And I know that there are a lot of allegations that, you know, management didn't want to see fraud and things like that. But the people that I know that do this, they're professionals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were very active in identifying issues, both pre-funding and post-funding within their institutions.
Do you think that certain aspects of that business model, whereas a sales associate could overrule the appraisal of, you know, the senior appraiser?
Well, I don't know that a sales associate did, but a sales associate could probably go up the ladder to someone who could.
Okay.
And, you know, I don't know if you're talking about a specific situation within New Century. If so, I'm not aware of it, but there definitely was an ability at levels to make discretionary judgments about accepting loans. And, you know, when you think about what a lender is doing in the underwriting process, for the most part, you know, that makes sense. It's a decision as to whether or not the institution is willing to accept the level of risk presented by a particular loan.
Mm-hmm.
And if they have all the information and they make the decision that they're willing to accept that risk, then what do they get? If they accepted an inappropriate amount of risk, right?
Right.
They get a loan that doesn't perform and it affects their financial stability and their product, this or their profit. This just happened on a much larger scale than, you know, one bad decision on a loan.
There's been a lot of talk about fraud in the secondary market, you know, with Fannie and Freddie and the securitization of those loans into, you know, mortgage-backed securities. To what extent do you think that fraud played in these investments, their securitizations? I mean, do you think they were knowingly securitized so people could take the short position on them?
No, I know that after the market started to tank, there were securities that were created that were completely comprised of bad loans, and they were, you know, principal positions, not interest positions in the loans. But as far as, you know, intentionally developing fraud loans to securitize them, or Fannie and Freddie being involved in, you know, taking fraudulent loans to have them securitized in order to short them, I just don't buy into that. I look at it as conspiracy theorists. But that's just me. I just, you know, I've worked around large institutions for long enough not to subscribe to the theory that there's a great brain out there that's all working in tandem.
Right.
I find that most of the bad conduct that happens at institutions happens from a lack of attention and maybe a lack of realization of risk, and oftentimes because lower-level employees make decisions and the issues aren't brought to the level of senior management who actually can make a risk-based decision rather than, you know, evil and conspiracy.
If I could ask you to put on your law professor and policymaking cap for a minute, can you talk about maybe what type of regulation at the federal or state levels could have possibly prevented a lot of this fraudulent conduct in the area of mortgage loan fraud? And specifically, let's say, initially in the area of mortgage origination?
Well, I think it would all go away if we got rid of commission-based compensation, but that's a pipe dream. I don't know that I'm necessarily... I don't necessarily know that enhanced regulation can help. We definitely, moving to a federal rather than a state-based regulatory scheme in the entire mortgage industry, I think would be very helpful, because lending is not a local practice, and lending is a national business. And the segregation and licensing, the patchwork, you know, state regulations, the lack of funding to administrative agencies enforced with, you know, regulating the various different players within the mortgage industry, from real estate agents to mortgage brokers to appraisers, the lack of, you know, uniform federal licensing or even ability to obtain information on various different players creates a huge problem on the fraud side. You know, we have folks that have criminal records who have engaged in mortgage fraud who leave a state and start a practice in another state. And they continue to originate fraudulent loans, and nobody knows. And it happens more often, I think, than the industry cares to admit. But there's really no way to track. Now, the NMLS system has come online, and hopefully we'll be able to track at least our loan originators. But what about our appraisers? And what about our escrow agents and our notary publics? There's an interesting one. Look at notaries. Mm-hmm. To pay $5 to $10 per signature.
I can tell you. I can tell you. I've run into the notary problem on more than one occasion. And I actually spoke to the head notary in the state of Virginia, who said that, and I couldn't believe this was true, that you are not required in the state of Virginia to write down any information of anyone that appears before you as a notary. Mm-hmm. I found that astounding, because across the river in Maryland, it's a state law.
Mm-hmm. They're not even required to keep a notary book, right?
In Maryland, they are,
so,
yes.
Yeah. But in Virginia, they're not.
No.
So in California, we are the only state that requires a thumbprint on a real property transaction.
Really?
Yep. Hmm. And it's so simple. And then you look at notaries, and they get paid $5 to $10, and they carry $10,000 bonds. And that's all.
Wow.
You know, bonding and mandatory insurance, I think, would be helpful.
For notaries?
Not just notaries. I mean, appraisers, brokers. What are the bonds that are required to be carried by broker-dealers in the securities industry?
Right. There are surety bonds, and then fidelity,
exactly.
And then fidelity bonds as well.
Mm-hmm. In, the appraisal industry, they suggested bonding a couple of years ago, but it was a ridiculous proposal. They wanted them to bond at a percentage of the gross dollar value of appraisals that they did in a year, which was just insane. It was like 5 or 10% of the gross dollar value of appraisals they issued. And no appraiser would have been in business ever again.
No.
Because the cost of the bond would have been insane. Especially you look at a residential mortgage transaction, $500,000 transaction, and they're doing maybe 10 appraisals a week. So what? That's, $5 million a week.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, do you think like trade organizations that represent these types of professionals had anything to do, in resisting regulation?
I think they all work for their industries, and that's how our legislative process works. So I'm not going to fault the trade organizations for looking out for the interests of their members.
Yeah. Along sort of similar lines, but a bit different, as you're probably familiar with, there's an organization called FINRA within the securities industry, and FINRA is a self-regulatory organization. That has received its authority from the SEC, And within securities broker-dealer organizations, what you have is you have a set of usually very clear policies and procedures that are established, as well as supervisory procedures that are supervised by an internal CCO, subject to very close scrutiny and regulation by the self-regulatory organizations, by specifically FINRA. And what I was going to ask you is, would a similar scheme work within the mortgage brokerage industry, particularly in light of the fact that, you know, government resources are limited, but yet if the self-policing mechanism is pushed down to the businesses themselves, whereby they have to establish internal controls, policies, and procedures, and self-police, with very, you know, very harsh penalties in the event that they fail to do that. Do you feel like that would maybe be a more appropriate structure within the current mortgage industry?
And that might be helpful in inside the current industry structure. Anything that raises awareness and accountability on the industry participants, especially when you delegate it to the business owners, because that's where a lot of it comes from. A lot of it comes from the way that they teach their employees, and the fact that there is no penalty and there is no potential exposure in the event that their employees act inappropriately, and yet there is a huge upside financial incentive if they do.
Do you think that's a reason for, you know, I've talked to some people that have said that the mortgage brokers are kind of to blame for this because they didn't really care whether the loan failed or not because, you know, they really had no skin in the game. It was kind of, they're not taking the loss if the loan fails.
There's a huge amount of fraud that happens at the broker level. And when you look at their compensation structure and the fact that they had no financial accountability whatsoever, it's perfectly clear why. The amount of money that mortgage brokers made on some of these loans was just, it's astounding to me.
I mean, do you think...
I have seen, you know, loans with $50,000 commissions to the mortgage broker.
Jesus.
And so you have a mortgage broker who's gathering financial information about the borrower and submitting it to the underwriter who looks at it to see whether or not it meets program guidelines, not even considering that all of it was made up. And you know, there's so many pieces of the transaction and the way that we pay people within the transaction that makes no sense. And you look at the fact that we paid the appraiser in that deal $400, and they were hired by the broker who made $50,000.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, isn't it true that mortgage brokers that were unregulated entities for the most part, because they weren't FDIC insured or anything else, so therefore they weren't required to file SARS reports. But isn't it true that these unregulated mortgage brokers really were the center of the market for difficult loans and those loans that required, I guess you could say, more challenging underwriting? I mean, it seems that a lot of that business, the Alt-A subprime business, flowed to these mortgage brokers that were completely unregulated.
Yeah, and a lot of that product came through mortgage brokers. You know, some of it came through retail loan officers as well, and I think retail loan officers generally received more training, but, you know, it's the same type of commission structure.
Hmm. So would you say that there's a direct correlation between a lack of regulation and incidents of fraud?
That's a tough one. It has more to do with the individual involved a lot of times. Not everybody commits fraud. So will regulation keep out? And that's the question. Will regulation keep out the bad actors or stop them or shut them down or identify them and dispose of them in a relatively short period of time? And if so, then regulation would decrease the amount of fraud.
Yep.
But, you know, if we have a toothless regulatory system where bad actors are not faced with expulsion from the industry and continue to originate loans, which is what happened within the current regulatory scheme, then it wouldn't reduce fraud at all. It's just additional regulation.
Right. And so that actually leads perfectly into the next question. I mean, do you believe that the lack of enforcement of mortgage loan fraud cases during the height of the boom and thereafter actually resulted in an ineffective system of deterrence and thereby really led to an excess or an excessive amount of fraud?
I would say that the lack of administrative enforcement is more directly, I don't want to say to blame, but
contributed to
the lack of administrative enforcement more so than the lack of criminal enforcement.
Can you clarify
criminal
that
enforcement? Well, criminal enforcement is going to identify, you know, actual criminals who are out there committing, you know, fraud for profit and stealing money, basically, you know, bank robbery without a gun. But we have so many incompetent actors and so many shady mortgage professionals that if we could actually, you know, act on complaints to the administrative agencies, to the appraiser regulating agencies, to the brokerage regulating agencies, who would actually go out and conduct investigations and pull their licenses, so we could actually take some of these bad actors out of the industry on an administrative basis, I think that would help fraud, the incidence of fraud, more so than doing a couple more criminal convictions or criminal cases.
Now, the regulatory agencies are probably going to be very limited in their resources, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And so,
yes.
So part
they're
of
they're generally state agencies.
Yeah, so part of dealing with that would be to increase their authority as well as their resources considerably.
Or pull the regulation of those industries into a federal agency.
Why do you think that so few investigations by the regulatory agencies, such as, let's say, the OCC, the Fed, OTS, et cetera, or even dealing with the state agencies, why do you think there were so few investigations that took place into specifically the executives of these organizations, the people that ran these organizations, unlike, let's say, the SNL crisis period where you had all kinds of executives going to jail?
One, I don't think that it's really geared up. If you look at the lag time in the SNL crisis between when the bank failures occurred and when the enforcement activities against the directors and officers occurred, I don't think that we're there yet. And the other issue, too, is that I think in the SNL crisis, the executives were more directly and personally involved in the conduct of the institutions than they necessarily were. We're talking about a few institutions in the SNL crisis where a great deal, I mean, it was commercial loan fraud, large loans, significant losses over a very few number of loans and relatively few number of institutions. In this crisis, we're talking about residential mortgage loans, huge volumes of loans, where it was more policies and procedures of the institutions that stopped or that didn't prevent the fraud than necessarily the executives having their hand in the honey jar. I think it's just a different situation.
But at the same time, it would probably also be more of a problem of institutionalized fraud, as you've said, which training would go to help to prevent. as opposed to fraud that would be happening at a higher level, specifically with the executives.
Yeah.
Are there any other sort of legislative or regulatory changes that you can think of that that if they had been in place prior to this bubble and this run up in housing prices and decreased affordability, may have actually been able to help us avoid this problem?
Not necessarily, no. From my perspective, it's a personal responsibility issue for the most part, and each person decides how to conduct their business. And I know we try to regulate from the outside, but as long as you have people who are willing to do business in a fraudulent manner, you're going to have fraudulent loans. So I guess getting them, identifying them and getting them out of the industry, I think is the biggest issue that we have.
Rachel, let me ask you about that. Have you seen or had, or I'm sure you might have heard, you know, law enforcement goes into an institution and says, okay, you know, you have a potentially bad actor working for you, whether it's an underwriter or a loan officer, appraiser, whoever. And that organization refuses to admit it, refuses to cooperate, refuses to, I don't know, I guess turn over information about that transaction. Do you think that contributes to it at all? You know, does the industry kind of shutting itself off to the enforcement?
I haven't had the experience, really, of seeing the industry shut itself off to enforcement. I hear rumors of it. I've had U.S. attorneys tell me that. But some of it, too, is, you know, a lack of working together, because I know most financial institutions require subpoenas before they'll release information.
Right.
And that's a protection issue, and I've had a lot of law enforcement complain about that.
That's one of my chief complaints.
Yeah.
Well, because they always, you know, the first thing they throw up at you is Graham Leach Bliley.
Mm-hmm.
And now, correct me if I'm wrong, but there is a provision within Graham Leach Bliley that says for the prevention of potential or actual fraud.
Mm-hmm. But there are some court cases that have interpreted Graham Leach Bliley to require a subpoena.
Okay.
To release records. And, you know, it's the underlying, most financial institutions, I think, will release the underlying documents in their SAR investigation folder without a further subpoena.
Right.
When it goes beyond that, they want to be subpoenaed. They want a subpoena because they want to be responding to process so that they have a defense. You know, okay, regulation that would stop fraud. I'm surprised I didn't say this earlier because this is my soapbox. A safe harbor in the Bank Secrecy Act for sharing non-public information about suspected fraud between institutions. It would do more for stopping fraud than anything else.
The safe harbor provision?
Yes, because institutions can't tell each other. And so a fraudster comes in one door and tries to get past an institution to fund some bad loans. He's discovered. He finds out what he does wrong. He patches up his problems with his loan files, and he goes to submit them to the bank next door, and they get funded. And one bank can't talk to the other bank about the loans that just came through.
Wasn't a safe harbor? Go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, wasn't that recommended by Swecker in his 04 testimony?
Maybe, I don't.
And I remember seeing, and it's come up before, I've read it other places, that, you know, the recommendation of a safe harbor provision.
Yes, please.
is there any reason, I think it's been proposed by FinCEN too, but I don't quote me on that. Is there a reason that hasn't come to fruition yet?
I don't know. I don't know that it's ever been proposed in any legislation. There is a, you know, safe harbor, there's an exception under the Bank Secrecy Act for terrorists.
Right.
For evidence of terrorist activity.
Mm-hmm.
But there should be one for, you know, mortgage fraud, for fraudulent activity towards a financial institution, for bank fraud, because it's the single biggest contributor is the lack of communication within the industry. And, you know, even in those situations where, for instance, you know, there's a Mary database. They got sued for information that was in there regarding a broker.
Really?
And eventually, I mean, the court did hold that there was a qualified privilege. But, you know, there is always that risk to be sued both by, you know, consumers and to be sued by industry participants.
Do you think the banks put up the, you know, the subpoena defense because they know that they know what the thresholds are in the prosecutor's office and that, you know, likely they're not going to get a subpoena, especially if the investigation is in its early stages?
I have never been involved in with a bank that was actually trying to avoid giving records in a mortgage fraud investigation. It is on advice of counsel that they insist on subpoenas.
Okay.
It doesn't mean it's never happened. I've just never been involved with a bank that was actively seeking not to give records in a mortgage fraud investigation.
Because I'll tell you, I alerted a bank one time to that, and they were less than helpful. I alerted them that they had a potentially dirty loan officer.
Uh-huh.
And they were less than helpful.
Well, depends on who it was and who the loan officer was. I mean, I could see that if their highest producer, what they were being, you know, accused, that maybe that person was, you know, involved with fraud. And it depends on who you talk to about it, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because various different people inside organizations are compensated in different ways.
It's true. Rachel, is there anything...
I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I'm just saying that, you know, in situations I dealt with, where institutions have been subpoenaed and there's a request, I mean, documents are sought and we're requesting subpoenas, it is not over a desire to escape process.
Okay. Rachel, we don't have any more questions for you. Is there something that we've left out of our questioning that you think will be pertinent to the FCIC's investigation of mortgage fraud and its role, you know, kind of in the financial crisis? Is there anybody we should talk to?
No, I have a different kind of analysis or another analysis of losses according in mortgage fraud that might be of interest to you.
Okay.
And I just use simple math to reach a number. And I'll just run you through it really quick.
Okay.
Which is, I have the numbers through March 31st of 2009 that were released by the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that in those first 6 months of their fiscal year, they have had reported on SARS $1.173 billion in mortgage fraud.
Did you say billion with a B?
Multiply. Huh?
With a B?
Yeah, with a B.
And that's billion in loss?
In losses.
Okay.
SARS. So if you multiply that by 2 to get the whole year, that's about $2.346 billion. Approximately one-third of the industry is subject to mandatory SAR reporting. So if you multiply that by 3, it's probably about $7 billion. And if you look at the chart released by the FBI in, I think it was 07, it was 07, that showed the percentage of SARs that actually have dollar losses reported.
Mm-hmm.
It's only 7%. And so if you multiply that number or divide by 0.07 to come up with the right number, it's about $100 billion in losses a year that are attributable to mortgage fraud. Now, is that a perfect number? No. I also think it's probably a low number because, like I said earlier, I think that probably the fraud for property versus fraud for profit that's actually out there is probably about backwards in the FBI's numbers. I just think the numbers are a lot higher than what actually gets reported.
We're taking notes. That's why we're a bit quiet.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
a staggering number.
It is a staggering number.
Mm-hmm.
But now, one final question, just since you bring up these numbers about the losses. I've seen and read it other places that the banks didn't really care about the losses because in relation to their profit, it was small.
When you looked at the fraud for profit, a lot of times that was the case.
But not the fraud for housing?
Well, fraud for housing wasn't an issue then. And then when it became one, well, you've seen what happened.
Right.
It really became an issue.
Rachel, this just came to mind. Do you also deal in the area of commercial mortgages?
A little bit. I don't do nearly as much on the commercial side as I do on the residential side.
Okay. Are we looking at potentially major problems and issues also in the mortgage markets in the future, based upon what you've seen and heard?
On the commercial side? Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Absolutely. It depends on, you know, I mean, it's always going to depend on what happens here and whether or not we stabilize, because we could avoid a meltdown on the commercial side if the market stabilizes now and prices start to stabilize. But if it continues forward, yeah, we are going to have a problem on the commercial side as well.
Do you think the fraud has been a major problem in that market as well? And if so, to what extent do you think it's been an issue as compared to the residential side?
I think that fraud in the commercial mortgage market is significant, and it is not recognized by players in the commercial market at all. It took a long time for the residential market to recognize that there was fraud, and the commercial market is where the residential market was 10 or 15 years ago. They don't have any processes in place. I mean, they underwrite differently, but the number of falsified rent rolls, falsified financial information, I think it's significant, but there's no real statistics in that side on it either.
Okay.
And it's not discovered until things start to fall apart.
Rachel, I think that's all we have. I greatly appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
Yeah, well, hopefully it was helpful.
It was.
It was. Yeah, thank you so much.
And you're welcome to call if you need more information.
Thanks, Rachel. I appreciate it.
Okay.
All right, you take care of yourself. Have a good one.
All right, thanks.
Thanks, bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye. Interview has terminated. It is 3:23 p.m. on Wednesday, May 19th.